Welcome to Wilderness Podcast, a passion project about wilderness and wild places, with your host, Adam Bronstein. Hello, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Wilderness Podcast. If you're listening via web browser, I encourage you to exit out of that and to go to your smartphone through your favorite podcasting app, search on Wilderness Podcast. There you'll find the green logo with the bear. And you can pick up where you left off on this episode and subscribe for new release notifications. And you can go back and listen to previous releases. It's been a while since I've released a new episode. I've been busy with other work, but I have a mini-series planned for everybody. I'm calling it Wilderness 30 by 30. You're hearing a lot of discussion now about the initiative to protect 30% of the Earth's land and ocean by the year 2030. And unfortunately, we're not hearing enough about the need to protect land as wilderness or as national parks, land designations that actually protect the ecosystems instead of leaving them vulnerable to more manipulation and extraction, like thinning and logging, more livestock grazing, mining, these sorts of things. So to actually protect the land, we need designations that will do us good and will serve us. So we need to start shifting that conversation. There was a new House resolution order, I believe it was last year, that made mention of wilderness and under the 30 by 30 initiative. But unfortunately, the new Biden executive order on climate that mentioned 30 by 30 did not discuss wilderness or national parks as part of the solution. So what we need to do as environmentalists and as wilderness advocates is to start putting pressure and educate those who are going to be making the decisions and their recommendations that are going to be given to Biden in the next 90 days on what this 30-30 should actually look like. So in this mini-series, we're going to be talking with people working all over the country on various landscape scale protection projects. Some of them are wilderness proposals, and others have a little bit different twist. And these are the sorts of things we need to be thinking about. You know, these are the big pushes that we need. And this is what's going to help with the climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis. We can't mess around anymore, and we have to take bold and sweeping action. Okay, well, this conversation for this episode is very difficult, and I have not spoken publicly on this to the same level that I have here. The climate crisis, climate disruption, is an issue that's really permeated all of our lives. It lives with our psyche. We know something's wrong. There's a lot of denial out there, and I think that's just deeply rooted in an unwillingness to confront the truth, which is often very difficult to accept. So in this episode, we explore some of these truths. And I don't want people to fall into despair, but oftentimes there is a grieving process associated with coming to grips with a lot of this information and processing it. So if you haven't been exposed to this level of discourse on this particular topic, this can be really difficult, and especially if you have children or if you're thinking about having children, this conversation is very tough. But I think we need to root ourselves in reality. We're losing touch rapidly as a society. Things are deteriorating in many ways, whether it's the environment or socioeconomically. And there's a lot of conspiracy theories going around. We really seem to be going off the cliff. So I think we need to start facing realities and staring at them head on and confronting them. And yes, that involves a lot of pain and discomfort, but ultimately we have to have both feet firmly planted on the ground to be able to move forward and to start making meaningful change in our personal lives and in the lives of our friends and family and our local communities. You know, there certainly are things that we can do, and that's discussed in this episode. So I speak with Dar Jamil, And Dar is an author and a retired investigative journalist. He spent some time over in Iraq and then started doing environmental reporting. And he came across just how deep and dark the true state of our climate really is. We talk about Dar's life as an investigative journalist, his introduction to the climate crisis through his reporting. Climate is the biggest story of all time. His book, The End of Ice, coming to grips with the bleak climate reality we face, how quickly the climate is changing, having difficult conversations about climate disruption, personal rights versus obligation to the planet and future generations, transitioning from an industrial civilization to something new, and creating a life of meaning through service to others and to future generations of all species. I hope you enjoy this episode, as difficult as it might be to hear. And feel free to reach out and send me an email if there's anything you want to discuss that we talked about today. And I also highly recommend that you pick up Dar's book, The End of Ice. This will really help you navigate this really difficult and often traumatizing subject. All right, with that, I bring you Dar Jamil. Dar, thanks so much for joining me on Wilderness Podcast. I really appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Adam. Great to be with you.
And you're out on the Olympic Peninsula, is that right?
Correct.
And how's what's it like living out there?
Well, I intentionally chose the north coast of the Olympic Peninsula because of the climate crisis. I looked at the models of where everything was going, and I chose a place where temperatures are relatively moderated because of the maritime climate and plenty of rainfall, at least for now. So it's at the moment, it's a really pleasant place to live, because we haven't had direct fires here and such. So it's and along with not too many people living out here.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful area. I haven't been up there in a while. I really should get back. And I'm in Central Oregon, so I'm really not that far away. But a friend and I did a road trip back in college, and we went across the U.S. and went up to the Olympics, and it's really beautiful up there. The old growth is just gorgeous, so you picked a good spot to land.
It is. It's a wonderful place to live, and Olympic National Park alone is a really special place. And the coast, you know, just have all kinds of different bioregions out here in a very, very relatively small amount of space. So it is. It's a special place to live.
Do you hear many of those Growler aircraft from the Air Force Base?
We do. Back when I was working full-time as a journalist, I wrote actually a series of articles pretty extensively about that. We do hear them here, but fortunately I live in the woods and not like right on the coast, so it's relatively muffled. People, however, across the water from me here over on Whidbey Island that live near by the base, or, you know, it's a totally different story over there. But that's the thing about, well, probably anywhere on Earth now, wherever you live, there's always going to be something to contend with.
Yeah, that's for sure. But it would be nice to be able to set aside some places, and considering noise pollution. I know we've talked about this a lot on this program. The issue of noise pollution, and just, you know, finding some solace and some quiet places for us, especially as we're dealing with some really traumatic things happening on the planetary scale. It is tough to find peace in this day and age. It seems like we've just completely dominated the planet, and I guess that's because we very much have.
We have, yeah, and that's a salient point, and that's another reason I moved here. You know, I kind of, you know, digressed a little bit into started getting into climate crisis, but reality is that, you know, we all, and I mean we all, for our souls, need wild, protected places. And you know, there's been some amazing writing about this. You can look at Wendell Berry and so many other great nature writers. But just to even know that that space exists, even if you don't physically go there, there's a balm to be found there. Just knowing that here is this place, it's untouched, it's wild. And if I ever really need to, I can go there to rest. And that's I make it a point to go out to places in the wilds to do that. And, you know, I'm glad you bring up the growler noise, because even though physically that land is relatively untouched aside from climate impacts, You know, you can't escape the beast, you know, now wherever you go, like you said, on the planet, the mark of man is there.
Yeah, it's really forced upon us. And, you know, I'm sure the Air Force or the Navy, whoever's flying those, like, has a good reason for why they would want to be in those areas. But we just have to really step back and think about what we're doing. And it's just so overpowering and overwhelming that, you know, we want to be able to escape the stinks and sounds of civilization. And even when you just have a very small percentage of folks, you know, driving their loud vehicles or buzzing their small engine aircraft around, it really has an impact. And just being able to get away and find some quiet and peace is so important for all of us. And, you know, not to mention the animals too. Dar, I really enjoyed listening to your book. I'm finding audiobooks are just working for me a little bit more these days. So when I say I read a book, it's usually because I'm listening, but I really enjoyed it. And, you know, like I told you in an email, I've been, I guess my eyes have been open for about 5 years about what's happening. And I've definitely experienced some depression over it. But I feel like I've come to a place of relative acceptance now, and I've been able to kind of get back on the horse and on the saddle, in the saddle, and continue on with my work. But this is really tough stuff to talk about. So I'm very glad and honored to have you on the program today. So maybe you could start out with a little background about you and, you know, how you eventually got to climate work.
Sure. Well, again, thanks again for having me. And thanks again for reading/listening to the book. I'm always grateful to see that it keeps getting out there and touching people, even though it's been about, 2 years now since it was published. But for me, I really, what kind of set me on the trajectory to writing, becoming a journalist, and then ultimately an author was I moved up to Alaska in 1996. I was born in Texas, but I moved up to Alaska in 96. I always had this thing about mountains, which was kind of funny being that I was born in Texas. But I'd been up to Alaska. I'd seen Denali, and it was just like love at first sight. I just knew, like, okay, I need to live up there in proximity to that. And so I went up there solely to learn how to mountaineer, just so that I could go up into the high country. And that's what I did. And so I started climbing voraciously and ended up working as a guide briefly, and then as a volunteer up on Denali with the Park Service doing rescues, and ended up climbing the mountain a few different times by a few different routes, and just was just in love with mountaineering and just being in those wild places. But that also afforded me a front row seat to the climate crisis. And this was long before I had read anything about it or had any interest in working as a journalist. But up there, it was inescapable. I mean, just watching the glaciers I was literally traversing and traveling on just shrinking by the year dramatically, along with other really dramatic climate impacts. And just fast forward through some broad brushstrokes, I really started doing my political homework up there, reading a lot and understanding that, look, we're, you know, I was having been born into really a privileged situation of a middle class family that really had our basic needs met and stuff. I really wasn't raised with any kind of politics, but I broke out of that shell and took it upon myself to educate myself. And so by the time the Iraq War rolled around in 2003, I was completely outraged at the level of propaganda and hysteria. And then the war was launched, and I was up on Denali, and I just felt this. I was listening to BBC radio reports at night in my tent when the invasion was going down and the occupation starting. And I just knew I just need to go over there and write about how this is impacting the Iraqi people. So about 7 months later, I went to the Middle East and I went to Baghdad and I started writing about it. And then eventually, pretty shortly thereafter, started working as a paid journalist. And that turned into a 17-year career. I ended up spending over a year total of my life in Iraq over multiple trips spanning the next decade, wrote 3 books on the topic. But then that knowledge of what was happening in Alaska from 1996 onwards, from when I'd moved up there, that was always in the back of my mind. And as I became more deeply acquainted with the climate crisis and reading the very alarming studies that were coming out, I knew I wanted to get back into writing about that specifically. So I was actually living in far west Texas in 2010 when the BP oil disaster took place. And so I went down there and covered that and started writing about environmental issues. And then that was my segue into climate. And from then on, I really just took it upon myself. I basically became obsessed and was just writing one climate story after another. I was freelancing, writing for various outlets. And then I was working full time for Al Jazeera English over in Doha, Qatar, doing a little TV work for them as well. And then from there in 2014, I moved here and was working full time for Truthout, again, as a climate reporter. And then I that's what I was doing full time up to and during when I wrote The End of Ice. And for me, this book, The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption, it's the culmination of really all my reporting, because I felt I knew it was my last journalism book. And because I felt like, look, this is the biggest story now forever going forward, no matter who we are and what you're doing on the planet. This is it. You know, the existential crisis of all of life on Earth. Right. Like what more important story is there? And I was able to just pour everything I had into this book. And it moved me very deeply to write it, going around to these places around the planet. Some of the front lines of the climate crisis, and see them firsthand, and more importantly, feel them in my body. Just really feel what that meant to be losing the Great Barrier Reef, the largest coral ecosystem on the planet, or, you know, going back to glaciers I used to climb on in Alaska and seeing them completely gone, just literally. And these were big glaciers. And really feeling that. And so the book, I think for me was like, look, this is it. Here's what's happening. Here's what's coming. We all need to wake up and behave accordingly with the extreme level of emergency that we now find ourselves in.
Yeah. The book was great, how it took us around the world, and, you know, you traveled there and interviewed folks and got to hear their stories about the decline and the change that they're witnessing, and just the fact that we can observe such change on human timescales, let alone year to year, is really what should be throwing the flag for everybody to really wake up and pay attention. But humans are we're just not programmed to be able to really recognize and respond to change that's happening. Like, you know, we can react quickly. If a car is coming at us, then we'll jump out of the way, right? You know, all these sorts of quick reactions that we've evolved to deal with. But such a big issue that seems to be coming at us slowly is actually on geological timescales happening very quickly. It's what, 110 to 100 times faster rate of change than what we would normally see, depending on where you are in the world right now. Is that accurate?
It is, if you talk about it geologically, and then if you talk about in some ways, though, including the loss of species, we're looking at 1,000 to 10,000 times the normal background rate of change and loss. So, yes, it's extraordinary. And actually, in a way, to me, putting these numbers on it, which I can feel that you really understand the magnitude of what that means, but it does make it easy for most of us to just gloss over, oh yeah, okay, more numbers, more statistics, because somehow, and this is what I try to do in the book, somehow we need to try and find a way where people can really feel in their bones what this means. That like the analogy you used, that jumping out of the car that's speeding towards you, that's now what's upon us planetarily, right? But the total failure of scientists, and for the most part, journalists and writers to so far convey that is vexing to me, because God knows I've tried. I know a ton of other really, really fine people who've tried, but for some reason, you know, that just hasn't translated to the emergency response of jumping out of the way of the car. And then instead we see a dominant culture here in the country that's just still, you know, speeding up, putting it into fifth gear and punching it in this game of chicken that's only going to end one way.
Right. Right. And scientists struggle with this too, right? Because they, and you might have touched on this in the book, where they're so focused on one area of study, even if it's climate related, it's hard for them to look outside of that one area and to connect the dots. And that's what climatologist Paul Beckwith has done. You know, he's stepped away from just looking at individual issues as part of his research, and he's trying to connect the dots now for everybody. But, you know, even Paul is really conservative in how he lays things out. But, you know, he's outspoken. You know, the culture in the scientific community is really one of being conservative and just to lay out the facts, and or at least the perceived the findings of their study. We won't call them facts per se, but you know, over time these studies turn into meta studies, and we start really painting a dire picture. And I sent you that one video of the IPCC reviewer. Oh, what was his name?
Peter Carter.
Peter Carter, yeah. So if people Google or search on YouTube for Extinction Rebellion Peter Carter, there's an interview there with Peter, and he really lays it out, you know, and we need more of that. But, you know, I want to talk more on a philosophical level with you later about all of this. But, you know, it really does become a little bit too much to process. But at the same time, I think we really need to face up to this truth and to see what we can do about it. And what actually there is to be done is to be discussed. And we'll do that further. Personal prep, spiritual prep. Do we look at some of these new technologies, carbon capture, obviously degrowth? You know, that's just not going to happen. It's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is the end of capitalism. So, but anyways, what, you know, what are your thoughts about all that?
Well put. Easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism, because that really defines the predicament, doesn't it? Right? Because so, I do prefer to talk in broader brushstrokes now rather than the intricacies of the science. I mean, I do prefer to talk about the climate crisis in broader brushstrokes, because having done extensive research for my book and 10 years as a journalist and gone out into the field on the front lines of these places that are most severely impacted thus far with leading experts in the world, I feel extremely confident in my assessment, which is we're very much off the cliff regarding the crisis. And so that means so things like green capitalism or technology's going to save us or the new Green Deal or a certain politician or, you know, these, you know, things like drawdown and technology's going to save us, this kind of stuff is really like, to me, children whistling in the dark because they're scared. I think we have to have a very honest assessment of how far along we are in order to adapt and behave accordingly. I think, obviously, if I could wave a magic wand, you know, giant mitigation efforts like reforestation and different methods of farming and stopping all CO2 emissions. I mean, all these things should happen. They're morally required of us. But because of how far along we are, I think adaptation is the serious conversation that we all need to be having. So I think that that's the place that we need to really have conversations, because, you know, people who think, oh, you know, if we lower the worst case projection, if we can shave 1 or 2 C off of that, then maybe this or that's going to happen in a better way, is completely ignoring the fact of how much heat's already baked into the system. By that, I mean, for example, oceans have absorbed 93.4% of all the heat humans have added to the atmosphere, and half of that since just 1997. So one of the scientists that I spoke with said, how are you going to get all that heat out of those oceans? And literally in the last week before we had this conversation today, reports are coming out showing once again, leading glaciologists, people like Dr. Eric Rigno with NASA, are talking about look, the melting that's happening in the Antarctic and Greenland now is far beyond any of our worst case projections. We're all just baffled by how rapidly all of this is coming undone. So, you know, if we look at it from that perspective, we're going to be having different conversations and I think behaving differently as compared to people who think, oh, well, we still have 9 years left to, you know, or have like, you know, CO2 emission reduction goals, you know, by 2030 or 2050. That to me, those kinds of conversations are.
Okay, I lost you again for a little bit, but I got most of that. Can you still hear me?
I can.
Okay. Yeah, it's a tough conversation to have with anybody. I mean, we all want hope, but hope in and of itself doesn't really do anything. You have to look at the reality of the situation. And, you know, for me, it's like, how do we make the future as less bad as possible? Mm-hmm. And how do we reduce the suffering of people and of animals? You know, you also hear the phrase planetary hospice, that we should be entering that. But, you know, I think there's something to be done with trying to reduce emissions. But, I mean, there's just so many people on the planet. And, you know, China and India, and they're all catching up in terms of their consumption. Our Western capitalist systems have really made it everywhere. They're full of exploitation, of course. There's a lot of moral shortcomings and failings with it all. But regardless, even if the U.S. reduces, you know, all these other countries still have to keep up. But even with that, of course, the Planet of the Humans documentary really laid it out. It takes a lot of fossil fuels to make renewables, and sun and wind are renewable, but wind turbines and solar panels are not.
Exactly. So that to me, it's all part of just, we have to have a very honest assessment of the landscape we find ourselves in order to behave accordingly. And so if I still think we can use technology to get our way, you know, find our way out of this or make it less worse, or if I still think we still have time to have longer term carbon reduction goals and things like this, I'm going to be behaving one way. But if I think that, look, we're completely off the cliff, there's so much baked into the system, there's nothing to indicate that global governments are going to behave in the level of emergency and speed with which the crisis demands to start really taking some serious mitigation efforts. There's nothing to indicate that that's going to happen. In fact, most places continue to speed up, and you just named the countries. So if that's the world that we live in, then that's where I think we get into some of the harder conversations, or not necessarily the harder, but the deeper conversations of, you know, how am I going to live my life, and what are my priorities now, given that, you know, in even just 10 years, this is going to be a very, very different planet than it is today. And you know, what am I doing to serve future generations of all species, but including humans? Because I think that's where we need to be looking of how, and that's where the adaptation comes in. How can we prepare younger generations for this planet that they're inheriting, like it or not?
I sent you that interview with Dr. Andrew McDougall, Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. And to all my listeners out there, Alex has been running this program, Radio Eco Shock, for quite a while now. And it's really my go-to for the latest science. He does a really great job of doing interviews. Anyways, he interviewed Dr. Andrew McDougall. And some of his findings were, we won't reach the hothouse Earth, which is, I forget what the threshold is, but maybe 4 degrees or 5 degrees C above baseline, when we still have ice on the planet. So even if the Arctic goes, we'll still have Greenland and Antarctica. And also he points to that when we do drop emissions, that temperatures do fall back. So, you know, there are some hopeful signs there, but, you know, I don't think that it's enough. And like you alluded to, like, we're not going to be changing our ways. We're still going to be pumping more and more. the methane issue is really interesting now. Did you see all the recent articles about the methane releases in Eastern Africa?
I had not seen those yet.
Yeah, it's something about maybe all the rain they're getting. I don't remember the mechanism, but yeah, our methane releases are out of control. Of course, we have the Arctic shelves, which are relatively shallow, and they heat up, and the methane is released up there. It's also looking like maybe the methane bomb hypothesis isn't going to come true, but that's still yet to be seen. I don't know. It's a very interesting, just observing everything and kind of watching the show, I guess. I mean, we don't really know how quickly everything's going to happen, but we know everything's happening much faster and sooner than expected at every corner.
I think things like the report of, we can glean hope because, you know, here's this study that shows that once we stop emitting CO2, then the temperatures will stop rising. Again, that's like whistling in the dark stuff to me, because there's nothing to indicate that even if that's true, that there's not going to be CO2 emissions still being emitted in 5 or 10 years from now. So I think, again, just to have a sober view of what's happening, think about everything that you've read about the climate crisis since you woke up to this being a crisis. Every report about, you know, another record-breaking year of wildfires, another record-breaking year of temperatures across the planet, floods, you know, having 500-year storms every couple of years or even every year if you're down in, for example, Houston with Hurricane Harvey and things like this. Every major climate story you've ever read, think about how dramatic the situation is, what we've already seen, what we've already lived through. Now think about the fact that we've raised the planetary temperature 1.3°C above pre-industrial baselines. So everything that we've experienced so far and everything that is baked into the system that I kind of vaguely alluded to earlier, that's just from having raised the planetary temperature 1.3°C. We're already seeing crop failures, you know, this region, that region. Fortunately, so far, they haven't all happened at the same time. But once we get upwards of 2°C, which is in the not-so-distant future, we are looking at regular crop failures. And once they start happening simultaneously in different continents, then that's when we start seeing the billions of people die that Dr. Carter warned about. And bear in mind, this is an IPCC reviewer. This is a fairly mainstream scientist saying these things. And he just said them this November. And he also went out of his way to point about how the UN Secretary General, just during the last year, called this literally an existential crisis and specifically named humans, not just the other species that we're seeing annihilated. So that's the landscape. So in that landscape, how are we going to behave? You know, are we going to sit around thinking, oh, technology is going to save us, or, oh, I feel a little better because this study says once we stop CO2 emissions, temperatures will stop rising? I mean, to me, that's just more of the whistling in the dark. And the reality is our work is cut out for us just focusing on what can I do to save as many species as I can now? And I don't mean that literally, but I mean, I know that me personally can't go out and save a species, but there is work that I can do that would help things go in a better direction for other species, whether that's saving certain amounts of land, getting involved in causes like that, or, again, like I mentioned earlier, can we work with younger generations to help them understand what's happening, help them make different choices? Because, you know, I'm 52. Like I went to college and then came out of college and thought, hey, man, I have my whole life and can basically do what I want. And, you know, the world seemed like it was going to go on forever. Whereas, you know, I'm talking to younger folks now in the early 20s that they already understand, like, they're not going to be able to have any kind of future like that, that they're not going to live on a planet that's going to afford them open possibility and free choice to do what they want. They're going to be limited by these crises. So what can I do? What work can I do to help these people, you know, because all of these other really issues of getting lost in, you know, a scientific study that downplays the severity of the crisis, and these come out pretty regularly, is to, I think, just really take our eye off the ball.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. Really tough conversations, especially to have with younger people who are expecting one thing and are actually, you know, receiving something else. I don't have any kids myself. I don't plan on having any for these reasons that we're discussing today, but it's really tough. And, you know, the Arctic is going to go, right? It's just a matter of when. We're looking at, I mean, if you follow the trend line down, September sea ice is the annual minimum every year. It's looking as soon as 2 years and maybe as long as 10 if we're lucky. But what does that mean? What does that mean for the planet, Dar?
Well, that means a pretty massive acceleration of what we're already seeing, which as that sea ice has reduced in area and exposed more and more of the shallow Arctic seabeds near the shore, under which is the subsea permafrost that contains massive amounts of methane, we are already seeing pretty dramatic amounts of methane now starting to be released from across the Arctic shallow seabeds. And so once that, it's called a blue ocean event, like once that sea ice goes in total, and we're meaning we start to have a short, very short period, probably around September, like you said, where there will be a summer where, boom, it's going to go. And basically the Arctic Ocean will be completely ice free. And that means instead of that ice being there to reflect all of that solar energy back into space, or most of it, it's being absorbed directly into the dark ocean. And then everything, you know, that's the mother of all feedback loops, if you will, where everything really accelerates. And so that means that much more methane is going to be released as the ocean warms. And then, of course, all of the terrestrial permafrost is already in motion of thawing out. And there's really nothing to indicate that that trend's going to be able to be stopped whatsoever. And there's massive amounts of carbon and methane equivalent in there as well. So this is a really hard thing to talk about, and these are, but what I found is that by having these difficult conversations philosophically about what all this means, and going through the grief process, which I've had to do too because of my work as a journalist, and really process through large amounts of anger and sadness and grief and even, you know, times of depression, of course. But going through all of that process, as challenging as it is, I can say that coming out the other side, I feel actually quite energized when I really look at, you know, one thing that I'll share that really helped me a lot was I was working with an indigenous elder, still am, and he talks about a difference in philosophy from the dominant Western culture that we live in and the indigenous culture. And in the Western culture, you know, it's like, what are my rights? We have rights. And in the indigenous perspective, as he said, look, we're born onto the planet. Every one of us is born onto the planet from their perspective with two sacred obligations. One is to be a good steward of the earth and take good care of the planet. And two, to serve future generations of all species. So if I get up each morning being concerned about what are my rights, you know, I'm going to behave differently as compared to if I wake up and I think, okay, I have these obligations, and no matter what is happening on Earth, and no matter how bleak the future might appear to be, no matter what, I have these obligations. And so I have a lot of work to get busy with to serve those two obligations. And so really pulling those things together for me and really, really contemplating that and taking it inside, it comes down to, you know, what kind of decisions am I going to make and where am I going to prioritize my time? And for me, that looked like, okay, I don't need to do more journalism. I know the data. I know where we're going. I know what's baked into the system. I'm now going to shift my work into more of a service capacity of how can I serve future generations? How can I, what kind of work can I put out there that's going to help people find really a psychological or even spiritual equilibrium? And so now I'm working on a book with that elder that I just mentioned, where we're interviewing a bunch of indigenous people and bringing all of that wisdom to the fore so that people can kind of have a deeper ballast of a perspective of this crisis that comes from people who've already lived through multiple collapses, you know, who survived genocide, who they've already lived through abrupt climate change. You know, when you take a tribe from southern Florida and the Everglades and put them up in the Midwest or in Oklahoma, that is abrupt climate change. And they adapted and they're still here. So we do have precedent, not on a global scale for this, but we do have specific precedent and prescient examples that I think can be really helpful for us, especially right now.
Yeah, I think that's great. Really important work to do. And I try to do that with my wilderness work and my other environmental advocacy. I think we've touched on most things here, Dar, but I mean, the transition from our industrial civilization to something that's actually going to sustain us is really daunting. I mean, how do you see that playing out?
Well, I think really the hope I have for any kind of a smooth transition is only in a very hyper local way, to really those of us who are positioned to do so, to start taking ourselves out of the system. That's what I try to do where I live. You know, literally, and you know, I have community right here where I live. We're growing a large part of our own food. We're increasing that annually, already off the grid. So I think that in these ways, there's ways to do it on a very local level. And if you're lucky enough to be situated in a pretty tuned in community to what's going on, then maybe you could engage in that kind of thing on a community level, which is also what we're trying to do here. But by and large, again, if you look at the industrial growth society, the capitalist system, it's not going to go quietly into the good night. I think that we're set up for collapse. There's been numerous studies come out that really make this very clear, that it's not going to unplug itself. It's not going to stop doing things based on profit and expansion, which entails destruction of the planet and our biosphere. So any kind of transition has to happen on a local level. And again, that's the bad news and the good news, because it's the good news because that's something that we can all get immediately engaged in.
Yeah, it can lessen the blow. Thinking of the quote or the phrase that Eric Weinstein likes to say, it's the embedded growth obligation of our system, and that's kind of where we're at. It's you can't just pull the plug on it, and you know, degrowth doesn't seem to be an option. So it kind of has to just run its course. And you know what comes out on the other end of that is really quite scary to think about. People in the cities, and you know, once we do have food shortages, like where do the migrants go? Of course, Central America and you know, parts of the Middle East will start flooding into Europe. So we'll see mass migration and conflicts and genocide coming out of those. So, you know, these are all things to be aware of and to think about. I don't know. I don't want to say accept, but it's pretty darn near close to acceptance that, you know, these things are around the corner. And like you alluded to, you know, it's looking like this century that we could lose billions of people on this planet. And that's just a harsh truth to accept.
It is. I mean, it's apocalyptic, you know, the scale of the severity of the crisis and what's upon us. And again, that's why I come back to, you know, and it is important to know that. And it's crushing, and it's, you know, even after having written so extensively about it, I see some of these reports that come out, and I just always have to pause and take a deep breath because I know what that means. But then go back into like the philosophical things that we discussed of, you know, how are we going to choose to comport ourselves and staying very, very active in service, because that really is, as Greta Thunberg has said, you know, activism or action is the antidote to despair. And that's extremely important to, you know, find a deep meaning, some good service that we can be involved in consistently and really give ourselves to that. Because otherwise, sitting here just staring at the, you know, one bad news story after another is enough to drive a person crazy. And we have evidence for that, too. You know, I mean, you look at, you know, we are in a global crisis on multiple levels, and those who are involved deeply in their own process and in service and, you know, in some kind of spiritual growth capacity, you're experiencing pretty revolutionary rapid change in a good way. Those who are not engaged on a deep level, well, they're doing things like storming the Capitol and trying to hang politicians, or refusing to wear masks during, you know, of what happens when you go down each one of those paths. And so I think that's, you know, it's very important to really, you know, do good work and stay very grounded and really, you know, because no matter how bad things get, we always have a choice. How am I going to choose to comport myself, and what kind of action am I going to try to do to help somebody or something, as opposed to, oh, what else can I try to get out of this system while it's burning to the ground?
Right. And I think that's always been the antidote to despair, is to dedicate yourself to service and something much larger than yourself. And, you know, neoliberalism has really taken us down this path of, what can I do for me? Me, 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 me. And it's just the totality of that is equals destruction and everyone looking out for themselves. And, you know, what happened with the Capitol and the anti-maskers and the conspiracies, you know, I think that's all indicative of a collapsing society, one of in despair. Humans have never been rational thinkers, and you know, some of us are more prone to conspiratorial thinking, but I think if, you know, enough of us are in such dire economic, socioeconomic straits, we can literally start to lose our minds. So, you know, I can kind of, you know, I can draw a line there. It's just kind of part of the bigger picture. It's, you know, people are really struggling out there. And of course, this is in absolutely no way supportive of what they did. I'm just trying to understand the mindset and what would drive people to do that. But, you know, we're seeing societal collapse, manifest in different ways. And, you know, navigating that's going to be really challenging on a planet with fewer resources and a warming planet. That's just spinning out of control.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's absolutely for sure. You know, and it's a sober assessment of where we are and in the direction that we're heading. And, you know, but again, you know, we can change ourselves, and we do that by changing what we do. You know, we are defined by our actions. And so, again, you know, it's just like, for me, it's knowing these broad brush strokes of where we're going. Okay, I have a pretty good idea of the topography of what's upon us and what's coming our way. And so how can I behave accordingly with that in perspective? You know, how, because it really is. And I do kind of keep harping on this like a broken record, because I've had to kind of make it my own mantra. And it took me years to get to a place to kind of like, look, okay, you don't need to be staring directly at the train wreck every day for 5 hours reading the news. You know, you can still keep tabs on it, but in a little bit more cursory way, and then just go out and get busy with these projects that I'm engaged in that are helping the planet directly.
Right. It's very important. And I think, you know, there's a lot of work to be done on the land preservation side. I'm going to be doing a mini series here on the podcast called Wilderness 30 by 30. There just isn't enough discussion around this protecting 30% of the U.S. by the year 2030. Most of it is just, it's not very well defined. And, you know, President Biden didn't lay out wilderness or national parks or, you know, actual land preservation. A lot of it seems to be built around, you know, continued use. So, you know, these are some of the things that we can be doing. And I'm also going to be really interested to follow along with you and your new book and the work that you're doing there with the indigenous folks. They certainly have a lot of wisdom and experience to pass on to everybody. So, Dar, do you have anything else you'd like to add?
No, this is a really, I think, important conversation, Adam. I appreciate you having me on your show, and I think we covered some important ground here. And, maybe somewhere further down the line, when I get a little closer to having this book come out, we could chat again. But it's been a real pleasure talking with you.
I would enjoy that. I'd enjoy having you on again to discuss that book and to let us know what you learned. And The End of Ice can be found. Where can people find your book?
All the usual places. Independent bookstores, all the usual places, through the New Press directly. That was the publisher. But it's pretty widely available.
And do you have a website?
I do. It's just simply myname.net. So it's darjamail.net, which is darjamail.net.
Okay, Dar, thanks for writing the book. Thanks for confronting these uncomfortable truths and be willing to speak about them, and continuing your work in dedication of service to your fellow man and all the animals that we share this wonderful planet with.
Thanks a lot, Adam, and thanks for your good work.
Have a good night.
You too.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Wilderness Podcast. You can find us online at wildernesspodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe through your podcasting app. If you'd like to support this podcast, please visit wildernesspodcast.com/support. Thanks for listening.